This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Escape to the Country of Editing and Writing Weekends.
So, you might have noticed by the recording quality, we're not actually doing this over Skype at the moment.
No, we're actually in the same room, which is kind of weird for both of us.
It's very weird for both of us. See, Jules is sat on the sofa beside me and she's looking at me while she's talking to me and I'm looking at the microphone because I don't want to engage with that. Not that I'm saying anything about your face, Jules. I'm just saying.
No, not at all, thank you.
It's very hard not to break out into laughter.
We mentioned before, I think in the last podcast, that we were getting together for a writing weekend. A ghostwriting, as in writing about ghosts, not ghostwriting for someone else. And here we are.
So we're in, today, a very sunny Horsham, which for those of you who aren't totally and utterly acquainted with all the places in England, is in West Sussex, quite close to Crawley, unfortunately. Nothing against anyone who lives in Crawley, but, you know, my condolences.
Not that you'd know once you got here, though, in all fairness. It looks nothing like Crawley.
So we've been working together on a number of ghost stories, including a collaboration, which has been very, very interesting.
Yeah, it's been quite good fun. And the thing I've noticed that we do differently is I think I like to get the entire story out, whereas you like to do a little bit of tweaking as you go along.
I do, and I think it's because I can't get on with the rest of it unless the foundation is all there, which must be incredibly annoying for you.
It's been a while since I worked like that, so it's just been a bit sort of, oh, hang on a minute, I was moving on to the next bit, but we're still here.
I'm so sorry.
No, annoying's not the right word. It's just a case of, oh, I've started working differently. When I started writing, I did actually go back and edit as I was doing it, and then I found that I just wasn't getting the word count up, so
yeah.
Now it's a case of it gets splurged out and sorted out later.
Because I think what happens is that I will actually tend to usually get on with it if it's a longer piece of work, but if it is a short story, and especially if I am collaborating, I need to make the changes earlier on because otherwise I'll forget what they are.
Yeah, and actually when you're collaborating it does make sense to say, well, hang on a minute, I'm going to do this bit, but if we don't foreshadow that bit or if we don't change something around then.
I think the other thing is that our collaboration is we are doing a crossover between the Unveiled series and the Kestrel Saga. And I have the advantage in this because I've read two of the Unveiled books, and Jules has only read one of my short stories from the Kestrel Saga.
Yeah, so I know much less about Kestrel
than I do about Emmeline. Except I've been spelling her name wrong for last year, at least, I've been spelling her name wrong.
In fairness, I didn't notice you'd actually been spelling it wrong until I looked at it this morning and thought, there's an I in that. There wasn't an I in it when I wrote it. She must have thought it was a typo.
So we thought we would talk a little bit about our experiences of putting together this anthology over this weekend. And also, we would talk a little bit about what we're escaping from at the moment, which is namely the mountain of editing that we've both been doing. And editing is a tremendous part of being a writer, and so I think this episode is probably aimed toward you guys in particular out there who are also on the writing path.
But you might be interested as readers to know exactly what goes into making a book, and it would be lovely to think it all flowed fresh and absolutely unneedful of any sort of change or intervention straight from the keyboard or the pen. Alas, it does not do that.
No.
When writers talk about editing, what they really mean is that all writing is rewriting, and you might do several drafts of a book. You might do 8 or 9 drafts of a book before the book is actually ready to even send to anybody to be creatively or structurally edited and then copy edited. So it goes through a lot of stages.
It also, it's interesting to talk, obviously, about editing, because we've mentioned in previous episodes, we talked about fan fiction and quality control and that respect. Editing is really what makes a novel. The only thing a first draft needs to be perfect, is complete. Editing is the thing which is going to really make it shine. You know, it's the difference between having, you know, a diamond in the rough and then having the jewel, which is, you know, the centrepiece of the necklace. And so editing is a crucial part of the writing process. And as a creative writing student and now a part-time lecturer, you know, a lot of people who are looking into going into creative writing say, what, so you'll teach us how to write? And actually, no. Most creative writing courses have nothing to do with teaching pupils how to write, and all much more to do with teaching pupils how to edit.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. And it's one of them, I have to say, the only actual writing course of any kind that I really went on was an online course that was about self-editing your novel, learning how to do that rewriting process and learning what to look out for. And I highly recommend doing something like that. That's, you know, that's not a waste of time or money. That's something that you absolutely need to learn to do.
Editing is incredibly painful. It can be quite fun.
Yeah.
It can be quite fun. For the most part, it's like, you know, slowly setting yourself on fire.
Sort of roasting yourself.
Yeah,
spit,
like roasting
it.
Like at first, it's like getting into a sort of cauldron, which is slowly sort of bubbling. And at first, it's like, oh, it's quite nice. It's a little bit like a bath. And then, you know, after a while, you're like, ha ha, I'm literally boiling alive. And it's definitely uncomfortable in places. Not least because when you edit, you need to find that line between being passionate enough about your work to still be looking at it after several weeks, but also being cold and indifferent enough about your work to just get rid of entire paragraphs.
Yeah, and it is finding that balancing act that's so difficult. I mean, how many complete drafts do you think you did for the first edition of Sons of Hestion?
Oh god,
rough guesstimate.
4 or 5?
Yeah.
4 or 5.
See, I did 7 for I Belong to the Earth. This isn't a competition, this is just how many I felt I needed to do. And then it went off to agents, and some of them came back to me with lovely suggestions. It wasn't quite what they were looking for at the time. And I ended up rewriting it again, I think another 2 or 3, yeah, 2 occasions. So overall, it had a lot of drafts before it ever got picked up and published, and then went through a creative edit and then a copy edit. So
yeah, well, yeah, so Sons of Hestion went through about 5 different drafts. You know, I wrote the first time, 17, got it out in 6 months. Writing that was, it took no time at all to write the actual first book. Then I rewrote it, then I rewrote it again, then I rewrote it. Then, of course, it got the copy editing and proofreading, and then for the second edition I rewrote it, and then I rewrote it again, and now it's going through another copy edit. So actually maybe Jules, it needed a few more.
I don't know. I mean, the thing is, you put out the most perfect book you can, and then you carry on writing and you write more books, and as you write more books you get more engagement, you grow into your voice a lot more.
Yeah.
And I don't think that you learn better techniques, and you don't ever stop learning, otherwise you just become a bit sort of stagnant as a writer. So it was right at the time, and now that you're putting out a second edition, it's like, well, I can tighten that up a bit, and I've got the opportunity to. And it was the same with I Belong to the Earth, because I've just been through it again, which I think takes me to around 13. But there were things in there that I wouldn't have known before, and now that I've learned, I'm like, I don't like that turn of phrase quite like that. So I haven't structurally changed the story, but I have tightened up bits and pieces here. Okay, really good example of things you tend to do as an inexperienced writer. You, without realising you're doing it, will say, that a character started to do something or began to do something. You will also say they looked. And you will also say they turned. And the absolute classic is he turned to look or she turned to look back. And the amount of times you can get that into a single paragraph between just two characters is utterly terrifying.
Oh God, I'm so guilty. I'm so guilty.
Without realising you're doing it. And the thing is that that's just a case of inexperience. And once you go back and... What I did with I Belong to the Earth is I highlighted all those instances. And when I looked through, they were all highlighted in different colours. And I was like, oh my God. But it's not as bad as it looked. It looked worse than it was. But some of them genuinely deserved to be there. And some of them, it was a case of, no, you've actually really gone round the houses with that sentence.
Yeah, and one of the things I'm doing actually is I'm going through the Sons of Thirstian at the moment is I'm noting down all the words that I feel like I'm seeing a lot of, and then when I've been back through it, I'm going to look back through it just for those words alone.
Yeah.
Try and get rid of them, and unfortunately there are always some. It's odd though, because there's going to be a word which will only appear once or twice, but will stick in people's minds. And this is just an example. Okay, so Sarah J. Maas. Have you noticed that she uses the word buttery?
Not to the extent you have, in fairness.
No.
But I think I noticed something else about what she... I don't know, there was a different turn of phrase. I can't remember it off the top of my head, but at the time it struck me as sort of, didn't we have that a few chapters ago?
Yeah. No, I guess I noticed her saying buttery because she talked about buttery light at one point, and I thought, oh, that's so nice. I loved that description. And then we got buttery something else later on. I felt cheated.
Choose another dairy product. Cheesy. Milky.
It was the light filtered through the curtains like curdled milk.
Another one that comes up a lot, and it's not just me, I'm glad to say, but I am guilty of doing it a little bit, even though I was conscious of trying not to do it, is to say that something seems to be something, when what you really mean is, it is something. Things should only seem to be something if there really is some doubt that they are what they are saying they are.
See, I'll use seemed sometimes if another character is observing someone else's, sort of trying to guess what they're feeling.
Yeah, but that makes sense. But sometimes you can cut that and
you can
make
cut
it shorthand.
Yeah.
But it makes sense to do it if it's an observation, but it doesn't make sense to do it if a character is just sort of, you know, looking at the sunset and saying, the sun seemed to be going down. It's like, what? Is it going down? Isn't it? Is the sun being deceptive at this point in time? Does it have some Machiavellian scheme to trick you into thinking it's setting when in fact it's not? Unless it's a conscious body, it probably shouldn't be seeming to do anything.
I guess you could use that as like the moon seemed to be waxing, like, because that then it could be, well, I think it's waxing, but it might not be.
Yeah,
it might be waning.
I can't tell what time it is.
Yeah,
in
but usually you can tell if the sun is setting or not. I mean, usually. Is it setting? Nah, mate. It's rising. Oh, wow. Where have I been?
So, yeah, things should not be seeming. They should be just being, unless there's a very good reason for them seeming.
So, yeah, one of the key things you can do when you're editing is recognise particular tripfalls that you yourself are want to fall into. And when you know what those are, editing does ultimately become a lot easier. But you will always find more. You'll always find that trends appear. The editing journey is never over, really. You have to decide when it's over, because otherwise you could be editing for the rest of time.
Yeah. I mean, there are personal things that where you just find that you use a particular mode of speech or a particular thing to communicate things more. The other thing I thought I was doing a lot of, and it turned out I was doing a lot of it, was talking about the character's eyes. Not in a sort of descriptive lyrical sense, just in a, you know, a lot of the communication seems to be going on from, you know, eyes and things, and it was a case of taking out the unnecessary ones.
All my characters shrug and look. It's a lot of looking, there's a lot of shrugging. And a lot of eyebrows being raised, because after a certain point, you can talk about mouths going slack, and people just go, that was the problem I have an editor, is they're like, show, don't tell us this, show it. And I'm like, there's only so many times that I can show what surprise looks like before everyone just goes, hold on a second, these people just seem to continuously have their mouths agape.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing with expressions and things. You might have a signature expression for a character, and that's okay, as long as you don't overdo it. But at the same time, you've got to be careful how it comes across to people. Like, you probably shouldn't use sigh too much, because it can make a character seem like a complete wuss. And I realised I was doing that as well.
Rufus is just one big sigh, so... That said, I did manage to do, and I felt quite proud of myself at this, is that I managed to put in something which meant that I didn't have to describe what Rufus's expression was in order to tell the audience that he was upset, which is that he runs his hands through his hair.
Yeah.
And so all I had to do was say that he was running his hands through his hair, and you immediately know that he's not a happy bunny.
Yeah, and to be honest, that almost communicates itself like good punctuation, because it's in there. You've clearly shown at the beginning that that's what he does when he's upset, and then later on it's a case of, well, he's just done that, it's not so big, but it's leaping in your face, and it's still communicating that he's upset right now, without saying, he was upset.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to be too on the nose with it either.
No, I mean, and I was quite pleased with how I did it, because you literally explained right at the beginning where he toys with his hair, and Torin just goes, I know something's wrong, because every time you're upset, you play with that hair of yours, and Rufus says, no, I don't. And then later on, he toys with his hair, and Yona sort of looks him straight in the face and just goes, what's wrong?
Yeah.
So you immediately have that, you know, that connection. And that was a good way around it. And actually what I found was that if I was getting stuck on trying to explain expressions and stuff like that, the best thing to do was actually find a tick for each of the characters which you could associate only with them. You know, certain behaviour that they would always fall back on when they were in certain moods. And you slowly introduce it at the beginning. And then by the end, your readers will know what each of those behaviours means. Just as they get to know the characters, they get to know, you know, their tells.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I have M, whenever she's feeling defensive, she starts hunching her shoulders up.
She's like a hedgehog.
But the thing is, it probably looks really quite strange, because she's about 5'10", so the fact that she then starts to try and make herself look small is both ludicrous and also quite funny at the same time.
I just realised something. I just remembered something. Sorry, crossover story. Emmeline sees Kestrel and describes her as short, and I was so offended. But then I thought Emmeline is 5'10", and Kestrel is, well, she's my height, so she's, I don't know.
You're taller than me.
Yeah.
Like a couple of inches. I had to climb on a chair to open a back door. Yesterday, Madeline just reached up and undid the bolt, and I thought, oh, I must be able to get to that. I couldn't reach it jumping. I literally had to climb on a chair to get it. So
I was outside, and Jill said, oh, I'll come and join you. I thought, she's taking a very long time.
It's because I was down at the bottom going, trying to reach the bolt at the top of the door.
You were locked in the house.
Yeah, that was all kinds of fun. I guess she might have to notice that Kestrel's medium height then. Because she's clearly not my height.
Kestrel is the average height of most women, and it's just that she's right next to Galahad, who's 6'4", and he'd make anyone look short. I think even Emmeline would feel short next to Galahad.
Yes.
Veritable mountain of a man.
So, yeah, aside from like a little bit of character height differential and author height differential, it's all going fine. You'll be glad to know.
Another key aspect of editing, which I've learned about Jules, is that she needs to consume at least a gallon of tea.
I don't need a gallon of tea.
Every single hour.
I do not.
I mean, I made a joke at the beginning. I said, oh, don't worry, we've got enough, you know, hot water. I'm not sure we do, actually, to be honest. Veritable huge tea drinker. Where I'll get up and I'll be like, hey, do you want anything to eat? And Jules will be like, no, I'm all right. And then I'll see her inhale and I'm like, here we go. And she goes, but I could do with a cup of tea.
You're making me sound like Mrs. Doyle of Father Ted. Hi, will. I'm not that bad. I probably need about 6 cups of tea a day. I should probably cut back.
You see, you obviously can't see her, listener. But as I look across to her, she says, I'm not that bad, holding the biggest mug that we have in the house.
It is a sizable mug.
Tiny little hands.
I think you could actually get most of a teapot in here. And, you know, this is probably the best mug ever.
You're welcome. Thank you. I don't think that mug's ever even been used. I don't think anyone's ever dared to try.
I'll admit, I did look at it and think, oh, that's quite big, but I'll give it a go.
But in all seriousness, we talk about having rituals that we go through when we're writing. And I actually think that the rituals we go through when we're editing are almost as important. And editing is a huge aspect of writing that is often looked away from. We talk about getting blocks just when you're writing. And actually writing a first draft isn't that difficult.
No.
It has its own, you know, pitfalls and it has its own difficulties. But editing, people don't believe it. When I say, if you had 100 minutes to do a full story, you'd spend 30 minutes of that writing writing the story initially. And then 30 minutes totally rewriting it, and then 40 minutes doing another thorough edit.
Yeah, and I think that's probably a fair summation of that. And oddly enough, if you are someone who finds it difficult to start getting words down on the page to start with, time yourself. Say, right, I've got an hour to get this number of words down, go. Don't look back, don't do anything else, just get the words down. And try doing it that way, and that quite often breaks through something so that you can get to a place where it just comes out. I mean, I'll be honest, I wrote the first draft of I Belong to the Earth in 3.5 weeks.
La-di-da.
And that's 86,000 words. So it can be done, but that first draft, one other person saw it, because we were exchanging bits of our first drafts as we went along, and really, I don't think anybody else ever needs to see that first draft. It's got bits in it that are just so dreadful, I sort of cringe thinking about them now. But it's getting that first draft down, because otherwise you have nothing to work on. So yeah, as you say, it's not that difficult to get a first draft down, but editing it is, I don't know, it's like trying to remove your own kidney with a rusty pair of pliers sometimes.
Trying to remove your own kidney through your mouth.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Today's tea shower was brought to you by...
So that's what Jules and I have actually been doing over the last few weeks. We've been editing. And when we decided to come on the writing weekend, we did say, right, we're going to just sort of throw out some original content. Which I'm sure must be then very frustrating for Jules, because she throws out original content, she sends it to me, and I send it back to her for editing.
Yeah. I know, it was a bit of a surprise the first time around. I was like, oh, I was expecting a couple of sort of typos, and maybe we should do this in the future. It's not sort of like really intricate.
Yeah, I'm sorry. And yeah, it's because I'm in total, even though I tried not to be, I'm still in total editing mode. And that's quite hard. It's quite hard to get, and the worry thing is that I can't force myself out of editing mode, because the moment the weekend's over, I need to go back to editing.
Yeah, and that you probably shouldn't do. But it's not a bad thing, and some people find that doing a bit of editing as they go on actually works for them. There's no one way that's right for everybody. Yeah, if you're a first-time writer and you happen to be listening to this, don't be put off by the fact when we're saying sort of like 8 drafts or 12 drafts, because the main thing is to get the first draft done first.
Yeah. the first draft is obviously the most important, because without it, you've got nothing. Now, we're talking about drafts. Here's something else to scare you. Jules, how many books did you write before you got one published?
That was the first book I really completed.
Yeah, how many before did you start?
How many did I start before that? I think we're in sort of probably 11 maybe. And it's some of those ones I'll go back to now and finish. It's just I've literally got them scheduled and slated into time. So I've booked myself into about 2019 for writing books. And that's not to say something won't come along and leapfrog over that, but there are others. There's the... I'm not counting the trilogy I wrote when I was 12, because it's just dreadful. It kind of hurts to think about. But that wasn't completed. That was a case of, well, this bit I really like, and I like this bit, but there has to be a connecting bit. Well, that's boring. I don't want to do that bit. So I'll just go back to that later. So it has massive holes in it as well. It was all learning, but, yeah, very rarely do you get your first book published. It's quite unusual. And it certainly wasn't my first ever book that I started.
No. I think... let's see. I'd finished another book when I was 14. I'd finished that and had a decent chunk of the sequel done as well. And I'd written something before that. So yeah, I'd definitely written quite a few books, which I did actually send out to places as well. And it got to the point where I went, okay, I've got to give up on this one so that I can concentrate on the next one. Which was very hard, but ultimately was the right decision, because looking back on it now, though, there was nowhere I could have put that book. As much as I loved it, there was nowhere that I could have put it.
I think when I was 12 or 13, I had this, I don't know where I got the concept from, but I think I had this idea that you just showed up at a publisher of your choice with a finished manuscript and they published it.
That's nice.
Which,
what a lovely idea.
Which is obviously so not what happens. Publishers get lots of manuscripts. They get to pick and choose. Or on the other hand, I never sent anything anywhere before I Belong to the Earth either, so...
It's because you didn't want people to actually know you were a writer, Jules.
Yeah, I mean, I had two desires there that were intensely conflicting with each other. One was the fact I wanted to be a writer, the other one was I didn't want anyone to read anything I'd written, so...
Yeah, there's something about that, Jules. You write stuff, it's so that people can read it.
Can make those two things work together, so you have to pick one.
See, I'm the total opposite of you. I can't wait for other people to read my stuff. I love it. I love it. Even if it's awful. Okay, that's not true. If that's a lie. Okay, I don't want some people to read some of my stuff, but I love being praised. So any opportunity, the inner child in me just squeals with delight.
It is great when you write something and someone really connects with it. That's a brilliant feeling. I'm wary of it because I think that can be quite addictive.
Yes!
You might then not you personally, but you, rhetorical you, might then not go on to do anything else or push yourself to be better, or I might not.
Yeah. Yeah, lots of shifting because...
It's nice to be sat on a sofa. Normally I'm sat at my desk.
Oh, see, normally I'm in bed when I... That's where I do most of my work.
You might really want to rephrase that.
See, that is the problem that I do tell people I do. Oh yeah, I do most of my work from bed. And they just go, okay. And
what do you do again?
I'm a writer. Ah, a writer. Is that what the kids are calling it these days? No, I just happen to be... Again, I can't say I happen to be very creative in bed. That just sounds wrong.
Well, you can say it if you want, but the tone of the podcast is definitely shifting.
No, I don't work at my desk. My desk, I put stuff on my desk, but I very rarely actually sit and work at it. which is useless, but so I'm not used to actually sitting upright. Sitting up, it sounds like I just lounge. I'm not used to sitting up in the way that I'm sitting up now. Anyway, that's not the point. We were talking about rituals as we're writing and as we are editing. Do you have any rituals, Jules?
Well, first I get myself a cup of tea. You knew that one.
Yeah, I did. I did know that one.
She knows that one anyway, because that's the first thing I'll do before we do a podcast. I'll say, are you almost ready to go? Yes. Okay, right. I'm just going to go and get my ritual cup of tea. And I've actually started calling it my ritual cup of tea. So that's what, I don't know. It's about getting yourself into a mindset, and it's just a shortcut, isn't it? It doesn't have to be a cup of tea. Ideally, it shouldn't be a bottle of whiskey. I know some writers do go down that route, but...
Yeah. Considering how much writing it'll be need to be doing, if you're gonna have to, you know, have a crutch, it might as well be tea. You're gonna find yourself penniless very quickly if it's whiskey.
Some writers do though, don't they? I'm just thinking of Stephen King actually.
He
found himself drinking loads of beer, and it was really telling. He was really honest in his book on writing, where he says. He went to get another beer out of the fridge and then compared how many were in the fridge and how many were in the, you know, empties were in the bin. And I was thinking, it's going to be the wake-up moment. At that point, I realised I was drinking too much. But no, what he said in the book was he thought, I've got a problem. I need to hide this.
Oh, dear.
And he went from, you know, drinking quite a lot of beer, you know, I don't know, what is a lot of beer? I think 15 cans over the course of a day of writing is quite a lot, really.
Yeah.
To, you know, drinking spirits, to, I'm not saying one thing leads to another, they sort of all overlapped, to doing quite a lot of cocaine and pot as well. And I don't know, you've got to choose your own destiny, ultimately, on those sort of things. I'm not going to tell people what to do, but... It was unhealthy because he said he genuinely can't remember writing some books and he regrets it now because there are books like Cujo where he really likes the book but he can't actually remember writing a lot of it. And he said he wasn't engaged in the process, and part of it was he'd put himself almost under too much pressure to produce. And it does seem to be, this is not an excuse at all, but it does seem to be like a creative black spot, if you like, where people almost get frightened of their own creativity and then start damping it down with things.
Yeah. I also think that writers suffer from their own stereotypes.
Yeah.
Which is that we see that apparently drugs or alcohol, cigarettes help with creativity. And here's another big one that people say you should embrace is depression. And people say, oh, yeah, depression is, you know, the origin of creativity. Not creativity, there's, you know, it's, you know, all great things come from depression. And I think it's very important to distinguish here that, yes, there has been some fantastic art that has been born from the minds of people who have suffered from depression. Except... I think there is also, and this is even preached on an educational, you know, level, where they say embrace your depression, and no, that's absolute rubbish. For the most part, depression is a real dampener on creativity. If you're depressed, if you're suffering from mental health issues, depression does not help in the least. Heartbreak, sadness, anger, these things, strong emotions will often feed into creativity, but depression and mental health are not things that you need. You don't need to sacrifice good mental health in order to be the best artist that you can.
Yeah.
And I think that the way that artists and stuff are shown in the media and how we're understood actually gives this new impression to all these young artists coming through who say, right, that's what I need to do in order to be the best version of who I am.
I mean, there is, it's the old sort of the poet needs the pain type
yeah.
stereotype. And I'm not, it's not quite as clear cut as that, I don't think, as you said. And there are people who've really, really suffered from depression. I'm thinking of Matt Haig, who is absolutely brilliant, lovely bloke, really, really nice, and very approachable about the whole subject. And he'll actually say, you know, writing saved my life. But the point is that he suffered from depression, and writing and reading a lot helped him to overcome, or at least manage it better. But he's perfectly honest about the fact that he went through a stage of almost going bankrupt before he got to a stage where he was winning so many prizes for his books. And he writes quite strange literary speculative fiction. I mean, there's one where I think it's, I want to say, it's a Shakespeare play. I think it's Henry V, but it's told from the perspective of dogs. And you've got the Labradors and this other type of dog. It sounds so unlikely, but it's really original and quite cool, if you like, you know, that sort of thing. And he's written other ones like The Humans, which is utterly fantastic, which I'd recommend to everyone. But, I mean, I went and saw him speak, and he said, you know, I really suffered from depression. I was suicidal, and I kept myself going through reading and writing, but it didn't just happen like that. It's not a case of I was depressed and therefore I produced prize-winning works.
No.
It was a case of I happened to produce prize-winning works. The writing was what kept me sane, kind of thing.
And I think that there is that intelligence and creativity go hand in hand with depression and mental health issues and anxiety. There is a relationship, certainly, between those two things. And there's nothing wrong with allowing your depression to feed into your writing. But ultimately, yeah, it's about making sure that what you're doing is healthy and you know, ultimately, where do you want to be? Do you want to be one of these amazing poets? You know, they talk about, oh, look at these amazing poets who, yeah, and they died very, very young, and they weren't amazing at the time. They were only appreciated afterwards. Yeah. Got to live to see it.
Well, it's like Sylvia Plath, isn't it? Emily Dickinson? And even Virginia Woolf, although I appreciate she had other health issues as well. She suffered terrible, terrible migraines and things.
Yeah.
And a lot of it was the pain in her head. I now wonder if she had something like temporal lobe epilepsy, because it sounds very similar in hindsight, but it wasn't something that was known at the time. But yeah, they weren't so much well known at the time. I don't know. I think you need to find healthy outlets where you engage with real people as well, which sounds really weird coming from someone who writes fantasy. But
No, I think that that's fair. So yeah, beware of the writing stereotype and how it may be affecting and dictating how you behave, because ultimately you know best what gets your creative juices running, and you should just stick to that.
So you probably don't need drink and drugs and things like that. I mean, and there are people who had experiences with mushrooms and LSD and then went on to write really interesting, insightful books afterwards, but I don't think the point at the time was, I'm going to write a book, therefore I'm going to experiment with these substances first. It was just a product of later on. It's like, well, yeah, I could really make something out of that. So, is what you do with your life experiences.
I tried absinthe once. I was given it, and I thought, oh, great, okay, so I'm really, wow. I'm going to go and try and write, and then I'll see what it looks like tomorrow morning. And you know what it looked like? Blank bloody page. That's what it looked like. I didn't get anything down. Nothing I ordained to keep.
I have never tried to write having drunk some absinthe. The few times I tried it, I didn't really feel it affected me particularly.
No, I just sort of felt a bit queasy the next morning, but like not hungover, just sort of like, oh, I probably shouldn't have drunk that.
Although you can really taste the wormwood in it, in my opinion. It's that's the Artemisia. It's the very bitter.
Yeah. Now, see, I've had an experience with wormwood.
Yeah.
Yeah. This has nothing to do with writing. This is just a warning that if you ever buy incense from Glastonbury, look what's in it first, before you burn it, in your room, with the window closed. Because if you start feeling a bit funny, I started to feel, I was just there like, ooh, something's happening here. And I thought, what's in this incense? And I looked at it and it said wormwood. I was there like, okay.
It's like, by and large, it's not dangerous. But then if you think about it, all plants are potentially dangerous in like huge quantities, or, you know, if you get a concentrated blast of it somehow. So yeah, just be a bit careful.
And if you're going to have to drink something, it might as well be tea. They're probably not the amount that Jules drinks, because I don't think any regular human could consume that amount of tea.
I know people who drink more tea than me.
Well, I'm sure you stick with your own kind, Jules.
Enablers. That's what we call them. I never used to drink tea. This is a fairly recent sort of... over the last 5 years thing. I'm becoming a British stereotype.
You're becoming an Irish stereotype, that's what you're becoming.
Well, yeah, okay, in fairness. It was in the genes, so there's nothing I can do about that. I could have gone the Scottish route and really got into whiskey instead.
You could have, so of the two, there you go.
Yeah, tea is cheaper.
Tea is cheaper.
Going back to it, do you have any writing rituals or editing rituals?
Well, other than having to be in bed.
I mean, I find with editing, I like to have some music on.
Yeah, I listen to a lot of original soundtrack. It really helps get me in the mood. Talk about being in bed and getting in the mood.
There's no good way you're going to come out of this, is there?
No. I repeat myself a lot as well, because I read it out loud. Because that's the best way that I'm going to get a feel for the... flow of what I'm trying to write. And one time I actually recorded myself, because I thought it'd be good to actually have a recording of just this little section, but I just read it as I usually do when I'm editing something, and then I listened back to the recording and it didn't sound at all how it should have sounded, in that I repeat myself obviously as I'm writing and as I'm editing. So it would be like, so he looked and he looked, he looked, and to the side where he could see that he looked to the side and he could see the... That's what it sounds like.
For a start, you've got look in there. So.
You're allowed to have look occasionally. He did look.
You are allowed to. It's when they're looking left, right, centre, behind, up and down within the same paragraph. You're gonna, it's like, okay, what's wrong with their neck? Why are they doing that?
My issue is always trying to... What are they doing with their hands? I suddenly become conscious of, what are they doing with their hands? Their hands. I've got. That sounds really sort of.
Well, most people don't wonder that. General, I don't think.
No, but I mean, because the thing is, I guess it comes from back in the days when I was still doing theatre, and. You would start to sort of notice that, as you know, especially when you're in a scene and there are other characters talking, you know, the director would be like, all right, and everyone else sort of act naturally. And it's one of my favourite gags in films, where they're like, everyone, quick, act natural. And someone comes into the room and, you know, someone's standing on a chair and someone else is, like, face against the wall. And, you know, if you're told to act naturally, it's actually almost impossible, because you suddenly think, actually, how do I usually stand when I'm not talking? What do I do? And so when the characters are not talking in scenes, I immediately go into actor brain. I'm thinking, how are they standing? What are they doing? What is it? What is it to look normal? How do I convey what they're thinking? Are they even thinking anything? You know, so
yeah,
that's when it starts to get a bit complicated. But no, I think biggest rituals I do is that I I'll get into bed and I'll put some mood music on. I'll read through several bits out loud, And then I'll take a break every few minutes to do some dragoning. Jules is nodding. Yes, good old dragoning. For those of you who do not know what dragoning is something I've been doing for a very long time. And it's where I stick my headphones in, put on some loud music, and I walk through a scene, physically walk through it. And I usually do it for fight scenes or highly action scenes, so that I can know where each of the characters are, how they do certain moves, etc., etc., etc. And one day I was doing it, and for a fight between a man and a dragon, and I caught sight of myself in the mirror, and I realised that I wasn't just being the man, I was also being the dragon. I just caught sight of myself with my arms up around my, up around my head flapping. And I just thought, oh dear, I'm so glad no one has ever walked in on me like this. And so from then on it was called dragoning, and people have just knocked on my door and said, we can hear a lot of thumping around, a lot of you jumping up and down. And I'm like, be quiet, I'm in the middle of a battle. So yeah, those are my writing rituals and my editing rituals. So, comparatively, your tea drinking is relatively
my
normal.
My tea drinking and music, it's usually classical music as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just dull, isn't it? Really?
You don't even fight dragons.
I think because I sit down thinking I'm going to get X number of chapters edited. That's the other thing is I started off, I didn't have a study or a desk for a long time, and I sort of lived a nomadic existence between the bedroom and the sofa, which sounds really, really bad. But that's where I was able to be on my own and do some writing, and now I've got a study and a desk. So for a while I was like, I can't write. I'm sat here at the desk and I physically can't write because I'm not used to it. So I had to train myself into it, weirdly, because you get used to writing in different places. Like some people go out and I think it was Joanna Penn was saying that she goes out and she does a lot of her first draft writing in coffee shops, and she'll do it first thing in the morning, and she puts her headphones on and listens to the sound of, rain, which actually I find when you're writing a first draft really does help, because it's like white noise, but it's not too intrusive. And because with music, if you've got anything with lyrics, you might then start writing the lyrics down.
Or singing along.
Or singing along. It can jolt you out of it. It depends, really. But I don't think I can sit... I couldn't relax enough to sit and write like that in public, I don't think. No. If I had a notebook, maybe, but not sit and tap at the laptop or anything. So, it's different for different people. When I'm writing, though, rather than editing, I can't just go straight into it. I normally give myself 20 minutes to wander around the internet first.
Yeah.
I don't know why, it's just...
You keep the door open, though.
Yeah.
You keep the door open. This is something I don't understand.
Or ajar. I do it at home as
well. Yeah, no, when I'm writing, the door is almost always closed. Sometimes I'll leave it open if I'm in a good mood. But, for the most part, the door closes. Because if anyone comes in while I'm trying to concentrate, I'll kill them. Just right there and then. Sean will sort of gently pat at the door if he needs to come in. And I'll let him in. But, no, I can't stand it. And there's nothing worse than if you are in public and you're trying to write and someone comes over and talks to you.
I think that's probably why I don't think I could do that, because you'd just be sort of slipping into that sort of alpha wave state where you're writing, and then someone comes over and interrupts you, or you start getting dirty looks from the person.
You did actually shoot me a look.
Did I?
The other day, she was in the middle of writing and I came by and I sort of hovered in the door and I kind of leant in and I asked how it was going. And Jules' eyes shot up from the page and they connected with mine, and I was just there like, good, okay. Just literally.
I do apologise, I didn't realise I was doing that.
It's okay.
I think I probably do. Thing is, I frown a lot when I'm concentrating, So I look like I'm really annoyed when actually I'm just concentrating. And then, of course, my brain's not paying any attention to the person in the doorway. My brain's paying attention to what's in front of me. I'm actually seeing what I'm writing, so it's not personal. but the reason the door stays open is because I have a cat, and the cat goes wherever she wants to.
Oh, of course, so. Yeah, I don't have that issue, because I am the cat, so no, it's fine. I am the cat in the flat. But I think the final thing about this writing weekend was that, for me, it was really... It is the epitome of writerhood, which is that we arrived and first night we opened a bottle of wine, and that was nice. You know, we got through that. We had a chat. We discussed some of the things that we were going to do, and that was very nice. And the second night, we brewed a pot of tea and had a tea party, and we spent the entire day in our pajamas, barely seeing each other, and in different rooms, communicating via Facebook, saying. And just resending drafts to each other. I think, you know, when I told people, oh yeah, I'm doing a writing weekend, I think they envisioned something very different. And then, as far as I'm concerned, we came down at 7 o'clock into the sitting room and neither of us had changed.
It was great.
It was lovely. It was fantastic. I highly recommend that for any writers out there, you take out a weekend specifically for writing, team up with other writers, and then you don't have to see anybody else for the entire weekend, because writers understand.
Definitely. I mean, I have been on a writing retreat before. I don't mean like the Festival of Writing. I won a competition and went away to... Devon and stayed with a couple of other people in this really lovely picturesque place, and Debbie Alper, who was one of the people who actually taught the self-editing novel course, was there doing a particular workshop on psychic distance, so it wasn't entirely just sort of left to your own devices, and it was really nice. Actually, I still got quite a bit of writing done because I was up about 7 o'clock every morning, so I sat and wrote for about 3 hours before breakfast. But it was, it's always a bit different, I think.
Yeah.
But the idea of being in a house with someone else utterly horrifies some writers.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the most important thing you can do as a writer and as any kind of creative is to reserve your creative time. And it is to say, this time is for writing. And that doesn't mean I'm going to be at home and I can do anything else. No, this time is for writing. And I'm very blessed that I'm in a relationship with somebody who understands that when I say I'm at home doing writing, that doesn't mean I'm at home and I can do the housework and stuff like that. It's no, from between this time to this time, I am writing, and there is nothing else for it. And if you can... be diligent with yourself as well, because it's very easy to say, oh, well, okay, I'll do some of the dishes or something like that. No, give yourself that time and allow yourself that time, and it will make a fundamental difference.
Yeah, actually schedule time. So schedule writing time, schedule editing time. I mean, maybe you don't want to be too structured about it. I haven't exactly started writing it in my diary yet or anything.
But
I know people who do, and it works for them to do it that way. They actually have a file of facts and say, from this time till this time, I'm doing this, and they will book themselves months in advance. So, once again, it depends.
Yeah. It's all about finding what works for you, but give yourself that time, regardless of when you choose to do it and how you choose to do it. Give yourself that time and make sure that people know that that time is sacred and that it's not expendable time.
Yeah. Writer's dates. Have you heard that expression?
No.
You effectively take yourself on a date so that you're refilling the well, because you're not an endless wellspring of creativity. So you need some time away from it all and it's quite easy to write yourself into the ground, actually. I've done it a couple of times now where I've actually been almost zombified because I've probably
poured yourself so much of yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I've sat down, my record, and also I think it should be my limit, is sitting down and writing 22,000 words in one afternoon and evening. I do not recommend that to anyone, because I was not right for about 3 days afterwards. So yeah, there's a limit. So take yourself out somewhere, go for a nice long walk, read a book, do something like that.
Find a castle. Save a princess.
Whatever refuels you. I mean, you've got to have something in the tank, otherwise you're not going to write anything.
Play Pokemon Go.
Well, I don't know about that, but you know.
It totally worked for me. I like the idea. I take myself on a date. I go out for a meal. That's what I do. Refuel my mind, refuel my body.
It's like, are you okay on your own? Yes, this is me time. I always think me time sounds a bit pretentious, but
no, that's right.
It's something you do need to
also
do.
Sit down and read something else.
Yeah.
Yeah, read and watch other things.
I can't read in the same genre I'm writing in at that moment, usually.
Really?
Yeah, it's too much of the same thing, so...
Oh, that's fair enough. Yeah, I get that.
So I'll read crime, or I'll read science fiction, or when I was writing the historical novels with Matt, I read a lot of young adult then, because it was good to read it then, because I was writing sort of fairly serious historical stuff. Moderately weighty.
Plus there were some very good young adult books coming out at the time.
Yep, that also helps.
Anyway, I think we're coming up to time.
I think we are.
But yeah, so this is Madeline and Jules reporting to you from West Sussex, Horsham, where we are now not quite at the end, but nearing the end of our lovely writing weekend of ghouly, ghostly ghost stories.
Yeah, I didn't even talk about ghost stories. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
We'll do a Halloween episode about that.
We will. Hopefully we might have something to show for that as well.
Show for that. Other than good times and a lot of tea consumption. So on that note, we'll say goodbye to you guys, and we'll catch up with you next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.